Welcome to the Right to Reason, episode 24. I am your host, Robert Stanley. Today's a very academic episode. It's a thinker episode, a thinky one. We've got a couple professionals on the docket to help us understand some rather complex issues. But before we talk to them, I'm going to let you hear some feedback that we've gotten concerning the recent debate with Blake Junta. You crazy listeners have been really supportive on patreon.com/right and also very helpful with advice via the contact tab at therighttoreason.com. So I thought you might like hearing a little tidbit of that. Then we'll be talking to former IRS agent Robert Beatty about another debate that recently went down on the podcast when I spoke with Kent Hovind. He's going to clear up the legal parameters around Dr. Hovind, so that should be pretty cool. Then I'll be talking to Michael Moore about autism. Let's get started.
And let me assure you that we are going to take our fight for economic justice, for social justice, for environmental sanity, for a world of peace.
And I think it should be religion treated with ridicule and hatred and contempt, and I claim that right.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are a wave, and the cosmos can know itself.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
Do vaccines cause autism? What do you think? Well, I'll tell you what I think. I think it's a bunch of BS, but I'm just some dude. Nobody cares what I think, okay? That's why I get the smart people in front of the mic so that you can hear what they think. That's my job, people! We needed to ask a professional about this topic, so I found the best. This guy is on the cutting edge of autistic studies. Michael Alan Moore is a cognitive blending researcher and occupational therapist that has some fascinating ideas about autism and how studying autism can help us learn more about ourselves. There's been a lot of conspiracy theories about autism and its relation to vaccines. I intend to get some real data about that question. And maybe Michael can explain this complex topic to us in a way that we can fully grasp its value. All that happens right now.
Culture is not your friend. Culture is for other people's convenience and the convenience of various institutions, churches, companies.
We very naturally, as a cognitive and behavioral imperative, we form descriptions of the world and we try to figure out what's going on.
If you base the design of rockets on science, they reach the moon. It works, bitches.
So ever since the Blake Junta debate, you guys have been flooding the righttoreason.com website with emails with your opinions and feedback on it. And I really appreciate that. It lets me know what you want in the show, and it makes me better at having these complex conversations. So I appreciate it. I picked my top three, and I thought I'd just kind of read excerpts from each one to you. I don't want to read them in their entirety just because it's a little long, and I don't want to spend the whole podcast reading emails or anything. But just give you a quick taste of what my inbox looks like. One listener said, "You pretty much caught him on most things. I think the only real blatant problem with Blake's arguments that you missed is that he doesn't seem to realize there is a difference between existence and your confidence in it, if it exists or not. He doesn't seem to realize that just because you are confident something exists doesn't actually mean it exists, and it is not an argument for existence." I thought that was an interesting take. Another listener wrote in, and this one's a long one, so I'm just going to give you the beginning and the end. "The debate was good. The conversation format, in my opinion, works far better than a set battle, and Blake and Robert's ability to communicate clearly helped immensely. Blake's position is well thought out and unfrustrated by non sequitur, which makes for a good debate. In the debate, Junta brings up a Bayesian argument for why The existence of a moral arena suggests the existence of a god, which Blake defines as a maximally great being or a being maximally deserving of worship. I want to put forward a few comments on specifically this argument that I felt weren't made by Stanley, although he did make several other excellent objections. And then he goes on to explain that a maximally great being wouldn't necessarily be deserving of worship. The greatest being probably doesn't exist. Are we a computer program? The moral arena under theism and atheism, the problem of evil. I'll read you the problem of evil and then I'll his conclusion real quick. As has been pointed out by very many people, the presence of evil probably does more harm than good. Not certainly, but far more likely than not, the presence of evil is bad. And as much as we are capable of knowing anything, it seems like God could prevent some of it. Blake has several arguments against the problem of evil, but at least for me, they are all very weak, focusing on defending against certain types of evil rather than all types of evil. Conclusion, the presence of all powerful benevolent being is very unlikely. It is not clear at all how we could come to the conclusion that a maximally great being exists, is material, could create the universe, and did so. For me, it seems that the probability of such a god is infinitesimally small. It's also not clear why the existence of such a being would even be helpful to the Christian's case. Helpful email, and I really enjoyed it. And then last but not least, this was actually a really just short email that I got, but I really appreciate it. It says, great job with the Blake debate, Robert. Keep up the good work. So even something like that, you know, where it didn't go into a lot of detail, but still meant a lot. So I appreciate that. Please feel free to keep those emails coming. That's therighttoreason2017@gmail.com, or you can just message me directly through therighttoreason.com. Robert Beatty, former IRS agent, to talk about a recent interview with Kent Hovind. Kent Hovind claimed that he had been incarcerated for 9 years for false charges. And Robert Beatty is actually very informed about this topic and might be able to help us out a little bit. Mr. Beatty, happy to have you.
Thank you very much.
What about these charges were accurate? What about them were fraudulent? How much of Kent Hovind's message about how he was incorrectly charged is true?
There's not much in Kent's narrative that one can rely on as far as a basis of properly evaluating the merits of his case. I did happen to catch his interview with you, in which he said, in part, I was given a 10-year sentence for structuring, which is one of the dumbest laws ever, and I didn't even violate it then. He then gave a reference to a website he didn't mention in your interview with him, that he also sent his wife to prison. He could have kept his wife out of prison quite easily, but he chose not to do so. And that's part of the context I see in evaluating his case.
At the risk of interrupting, I'm sorry, but just for the listeners that might not be familiar with the term, structuring is basically hiding money. Is that correct?
Hiding transactions that lead to money. He wasn't innocent of any of the charges. He didn't put on a defense. He sat on his hands, and I don't believe the reason he gives is the reason he did that. And he also wouldn't let his wife put on a defense. And he handpicked her defense attorney and wouldn't let his wife make a deal, which she could have easily made and kept herself out of prison. At that time, she went along with it. And then things fell apart. And now she's his ex-wife.
I am a layman to everything that you're saying. But if I was going to understand this correctly, and the listeners were too as well, basically, he is guilty of these charges. He tried to hide money, tried to avoid paying taxes, and also indicated his wife in this whole process. This has led to his incarceration, and it was a valid sentence. Is that what you're saying?
I have proposed over and over again that he was, of course, his position is he denies it. But getting the two sides together to properly discuss the merits of our positions, he won't face me. He doesn't want to talk to me. And he apparently won't face anybody else that knows enough to know how to deal with the issues.
You're a former IRS agent. Of course he wouldn't talk to you. What I really thought was neat was that he said, one day the Lord's going to come back and he's going to tell everybody that I was right and they were wrong. And to me, all accounting aside, all legality aside, okay, that's an amazing level of egotism, is it not?
I have, and some other people have noticed also, that for us amateur psychologists and psychiatrists, he exhibits some symptoms of narcissistic personality disorder, one of which is refusing to change your position in the face of overwhelming evidence that you're wrong. I don't know if he's acting or if he really believes what he's saying. I find it hard to believe that he really believes it. If he really believed it, he might have faced me or someone like me a long time ago and made his case. But like I mentioned earlier, why can't he just publish, for example, his legal authority for what he claims and has been claiming for years that structuring requires? He can't do it. I read to you out of the regulations the simplicity of what he was charged with that held up in court and on appeal. He even tried to get to the Supreme Court, and that didn't work. And now he's pledged the rest of his life to promote his false narrative via his echo chamber and the people that will listen to him, and even taking advantage of you a bit by getting in a plug for it with no rebuttal. So when I see that, I like to say, well, if you're interested, you had Ken on and he lied to you or presented his false narrative, you might listen to the other side of that.
But I want to key in on one point that you made. Do you feel like perhaps, and this is something I've questioned myself about a bit since the interview, and even leading up to it, that perhaps I gave him a stage to perpetuate his message that I should not have?
I wouldn't say that. I think it's good that people interview him. I think maybe it's unfortunate if you were not up to speed on what he was talking about at the time.
I certainly was, but not. I am a layman when it comes to tax law, as I think most people are. I mean, we're not IRS agents like yourself, and whenever he proposed that, I had already agreed in advance that these weren't topics that I was going to push back on, but even if I tried to, I wouldn't know how.
Yeah. Well, I think he does get by with a lot, and part of it, unlike in your situation, a lot of the people that broadcast his more explicit false legal narratives are already his supporters. I wouldn't consider you his supporter, right, but you may not have been prepared to deal with that issue, and he might have been rather stringent in avoiding it had you tried to get into it. I think in the sure. Bill Ludlow debate recently, Kent said something approaching that issue, maybe something about tax dollars going to evolution in schools and that sort of thing, and Bill told him, I don't think you want to go there, Kent. Bill is a member of my Facebook group on Hovind, and he's informed a bit were that issue to break out. But they had other issues to deal with. But it almost got mentioned in that debate.
Mr. Beatty, I have really enjoyed kind of picking at your brain a little bit. Is there a way that people can find you? On social media or on the internet?
The standalone website that specializes in Kent Hovind and me, one of my friends set it up for me after Facebook was giving us such a hard time, is kehvrlb.com.
If
you feel the right to reason and the conversations we have on this podcast to be valuable, then please know that while this broadcast is provided to you for free, it is not free to produce. Please visit my Patreon page. It's easy to remember. It's patreon.com/right. There are multiple rewards available to all patrons, even those of you that contribute just a dollar. You can also find the link on my website at therighttoreason.com. If you are able to make this show possible, know that your support contributes to getting the message you care about out to those that may not have heard it. Those of you that are already helping, know that we are creating this production together. All my listeners are part of this show, but those that support it are facilitators that are turning our whisper into a resounding message in the marketplace of ideas. If you think this show is worth a buck, or even more, visit patreon.com/right.
This is Russell Glasser from The Atheist Experience, and I'm standing up for your right to reason.
Thomas Westbrook here from Holy Kool-Aid, and you're listening to The Right to Reason.
Hey there, this is Damian Lee Four from the metal band Predator, a band that defends atheism, and you're listening to The Right to Reason.
We are back, very happy to be speaking with Michael Moore today. Michael holds a master's in occupational therapy. Michael, happy to have you here. I understand you're working toward a PhD right now.
I've just started. Trying to get that underway. You probably want to refer to me as Michael Allen Moore so people don't confuse me with the
the guy that makes the 9/11 Fahrenheit 9/11 stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. people are upset when they see Michael Moore, they tune in and it's not him, and they'll be disappointed if it's me. So,
well, just you and I had a little bit of chance to speak already, and I can tell the listener they will not be disappointed in listening to you talk about a very important topic, autism, not just autism itself, but exactly how that understanding of autism kind of impacts just our understanding of our own psychology in a way. Just to start off, like what is an occupational therapist? Like, what is that? Is that somebody that tells you that your job's okay? Don't quit.
The use of the word occupational in the title, occupational therapy, refers to any activity. Standing up, walking over, opening a door, buttoning a shirt, brushing your teeth, any type of task, you do. And then the subcomponents of those tasks that you do. That's what the word occupation really refers to. Occupational therapists work in a wide variety of domains, primarily physical medicine and rehabilitation, the school system, working with people who suffered strokes, traumatic brain injuries from car accidents, or other types of accidents, things of that nature, essentially. We work in some type of physical and functional rehabilitation, essentially.
Whenever I remember back to my college education, they were talking about different branches of psychology, and they would mention behavioral therapy. Is this kind of like that?
Well, we're not psychologists, although we do have a fair amount of undergraduate psychology work, but we're very hands-on. So it's not a talking therapy at all, but it's very physical, but we're not physical therapists. Physical therapists primarily are concerned with like gait training, walking, things like that. We do a lot of fine motor control and hopefully through purposeful activity. So there would lie some psychology at work. So I do catch myself at times sitting down and trying to make people who are able to speak more comfortable in their environments.
So it factors in like communication skills?
Yes. Desperately so. Yes.
Decent.
We definitely have to find purposeful things for people to do to engage in to hopefully help exacerbate their rehabilitation.
So now that we understand what you do exactly, can you explain what is autism? Because I hear autism being talked about on the internet or news or TV or anything like that, and it just sounds like something like, a kid is retarded. And I feel like whenever, I don't mean any insult in the word retarded. I mean that fundamentally, like, there's a problem with the kid. But I feel like whenever I think in those terms, I'm not really understanding the complexities of autism. Is that a fair question, at least?
That's a very fair question. What autism is a spectrum disorder. The quote that comes to mind, you know, if you know one child with autism, you only know one child with autism. There's so many variances of it, and it changes every year. It changes every DSM, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, when that's issued. They refine it, expand it, contract it sometimes, redefine a lot of the sub definitions of it. In essence, you can think of autism, it is a deficit model of some type of communication. It could be verbal communication, and it could be also socio-emotional communication as well. Some people with autism can use language very, very well, but they may not understand sarcasm or even some uses of metaphor, which then leads linguists and other people to think that there's a theory of mind issue going on as well. And that's where things really get fascinating with autism. But it's been changing every year since the 1980s. What's really important to keep in mind with autism too is that in our educational system, for example, these children by and large weren't necessarily, you know, they weren't mainstream before like the 1970s and 1980s. And there used to be a widespread diagnosis of like childhood schizophrenia that we don't really see anymore. They don't use it anymore. We don't define children as having schizophrenia. It's a very, very rare diagnosis. So a child like that back and up through you know, the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, they were being diagnosed with childhood schizophrenia, stuck in, you know, some type of home, probably medicated to control their behavior. You know, thankfully we don't do that anymore. But the result of that is that they're in the school systems, and the school systems don't really have any necessary model of education that over a period of time has been proven to be valid or have efficacy in actually educating children. So that's really the difficulty that our now society really faces.
Oh my God. Like just listening to what you just said, like I'm getting like an emotional thing. Like I literally have my hand on my mouth while you're saying that, because I'm thinking like before we recognized autism as what it is, how many of these children were just treated, you know, in this insufficient way, you know, or acted like, well, you're just crazy and just kind of thrown to the fucking wolves, you know, like it's terrifying.
Yeah, it is. Especially when, you know, one of the facets of autism is you could have a sensory integration problem. So in other words, loud sounds, lighting, things like that could cause just great emotional disturbance. So how many of these children were, you know, if you think of authoritarian upbringings, you know, how many of these children were, you know, probably unfortunately beaten into some type of submission because they had behavioral problems, because they were having sensory integration problems with
their environment. Oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, I can look back and I hear stories of family members, and you hear, well, you know, Uncle so-and-so, he was put in an institution in the 1950s. You know, he was crazy. And I'm like, was he crazy, or did he have some type of developmental disability? Did he have some form of now what we call autism? Did he have some form of this or some form of that? You know, I had this uncle that was stuck in a home in the 1950s after my grandfather, whom I never met, who was abusive, beat him so badly he had to be put in a home. But there are stories of this uncle having abilities with mechanics and things like that. And so I look back and going, did he have a form of autism? Did he have a form of Asperger's?
I think about my own kids, and you know, I'm one of those like nice dads, you know, but I'm also a very strict father. And I think like if my child, just as much of a novice as I am about this topic alone, and how much you're blowing my mind right now, which that, you know, like you've only been talking for like 5 minutes and I've already got my mind blown. So I must have a lot to learn about this, you know, like that's immediately the impression I'm getting. But if my child had autism or something, like how much, like I wouldn't know. And how would I respond to that in a disciplinary way? And it's terrifying.
That's the one thing it's really humbled me a great deal. And it's made me a very patient person. And I struggle to be a more patient person every day. when I deal with not only children, but also to adults, who I just see them as they have a component that's there. They have a component that's not quite integrated. And, you know, now you learn to look for those types of things now, or at least I'm beginning to. And it's humbling. It's really humbling. It's very frustrating when I see other people not see those issues and either become judgmental or respond in a very aggressive way or respond in a very negative way. It's disturbing to me at times.
That's neat what you say. Like, we think of autism like a childhood affliction, but like what you were saying a minute ago, I hadn't thought about that. Like, it's affecting adults, like children become adults, but it, at least in response to the childhood aspect, like, how does a parent know if their child has autism?
There's a series of questionnaires and just some basic checklists that a parent can kind of go through and check off. And if they have any concerns, I would just tell them to consult their physician and consult, you know, maybe one or two physicians. A child would show a certain amount of just social alienation, emotional inappropriateness, an aversion to certain types of stimuli, a type of what you say, a very strict mechanical type of play. Their play wouldn't be flexible. They would be very inflexible with certain things. With objects, they could be more interested in objects than people, things like that. There's a whole range of things that one could be concerned about, but it could be something else. It'd be worth it just to always have that, you know. School systems are getting better now with a type of screening tool when children do hit the system in early intervention as young as 2 and 3 years old. And midwives are becoming very, very astute in spotting these types of even behaviors in amongst newborns, especially if they have atypical motor type responses in the way the arms and the way they're having reflexes. So people are getting much, much better at it.
So here's a softball for you, but I'm sure a lot of the listeners have been just flooded with stuff all over Facebook and Twitter and social media, and even news seems to have like a weird, quirky way of covering this information. But I keep hearing the same thing over and over, especially from like celebrities and stuff. Do vaccines cause autism?
Frontline did a wonderful, wonderful documentary on vaccines. And I'm quoting the Frontline PBS documentary where several European nations, France, Britain, I believe Finland was one, you know, all those countries with socialized medicine that pump a lot of money into public health, did long-term studies of the components and use of vaccines, and they found no correlation whatsoever. And there's been, I think I heard another quote, there's been actually since the Lancet studies in the 19 Lancet study, which has been retracted by the British Journal back in the 1990s, there's been 17 studies done now, definitive long-term studies done on autism and vaccines, and there's no connection whatsoever.
And I had heard that Lancet study, that was the initial one. That was the catalyst of all this stuff. Yes. And then that the guy that wrote it, didn't he have his whole doctorate taken away?
Yeah. You this came up on one of your shows, if I'm not mistaken, where they talked about it, or maybe I'm mistaken, but another show. But that researcher was just had a sort of his own cult of personality for his own ego and published this erroneous material, and it really should have never even been published in the first place. It was so poorly vetted.
It's amazing that one little speck of paranoia has just flooded the social discourse like it has, and all the negative results that have come from that.
The fuel to the fire is the fact that we vaccinate children at around the same time that the features of autism become apparent. And that correlation causation mistake that we do as human beings takes hold and creates a lot of just misunderstanding and a lot of damage.
And it feeds in to that very core of paranoia that we have that wants us to have self-blame. Anytime we see our own children like doing something wrong, we want to blame ourselves, you know? Or if they're sick, it's our fault. It's that guilt thing. And I, my heart just goes out to these parents that, you know, they have an autistic child. They see some bullshit on the internet or something about how it was a result of the vaccinations they gave them. They feel bad, but it also appeals to that, like the government, you know, big pharma, all this stuff is kind of working against me. And it just, it's almost like the perfect conspiracy because it brings in all these different facets.
Yeah. As human beings, we would rather have a model of the way the world works that's complete yet wrong than to say, well, I don't know, you know.
That's fascinating. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Would you say that your model of the world itself, your religious ideas kind of help you understand this topic better, or your lack of religious ideas might be more appropriate, help you understand this a little bit better?
Yeah. Yes. Because I don't, you know, I'm an atheist. And I'm happy to be an atheist. And I see my fellow man as a type of, you know, we're a species of primate that, you know, have developed culture and mechanisms and things like that. But, you know, we are clearly a species of primate. And if you look at each other and yourself through the lens of evolution, you know, our behaviors, our anxieties, our fears, our mistakes, our types of self-destruction make perfect sense. It shouldn't shock us, you know, at all. And even with my own mistakes that I've made over the years, I'm going, well, that makes sense from this point of view, you know, from this type of insecurity, what I was doing in my teens and 20s. And it's like, oh, okay. It makes total sense, and it's very understandable.
I was going to ask, like, what kind of research are you doing to understand and treat autism better exactly?
Right now, I'm just trying to catch up on the research that exists, to be quite honest with you. Mark Turner is the big name in conceptual blending, and that's come into the theory of mind and with that's connection to autism. And really one of the big features across the whole spectrum of autism is this concept of conceptual blending or conceptual integration. And that is conceptual blending. And what basically that is, it's in and of itself, it's a metaphorical term used to refer to a powerful basic mental operation in which sort of our minds basically assemble stimuli in our environment of things like and things unlike, and basically integrate that and synthesize that into basically meaningful frames or mental operations.
Okay. So like right at the beginning, you said, you said conceptual blending, and I'm like, please explain that. And then you explain it, and I'm like, woo, like right over my head, you know?
I know. I'm trying to get better at this. I apologize. Please bear.
Well, it's hard for – I would assume someone with your education and your research experience, it's probably hard to speak on a novice level. But
it's – yes, but I have to do this. Or else I'm kind of full of it, and I have to own up to that. In essence, let's take, for example, if you see a number 2 right there, you imagine then 2 of something, okay, or 2 of anything, right? In a 1-year-old starts to do this, a 2-year-old starts to do this. That is a mental blend. That is a cognitive integration. You've taken this symbol and realized it's a symbol for something else. But it's not just a symbol for something else. It's a symbol for a bunch of other things that could be in pairs or be in twos. Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense. Okay. Yeah.
It's like the ability to look at a car, or like right now I'm staring out my window and I see, you know, a Jeep Liberty, and I see an old Ford Contour, I think, or something like that. But those are cars, and they're under the umbrella of cars. And that's a conceptual blend of car.
So like the blending itself, the term blending, like I think like a blender, and now I sound like a total idiot. But I'm just saying, like, I'm trying to, like, help under – I'm saying it back to you to see if I got it right. So it's like taking – I can take the symbol of 2, but yes, also understand what the 2 represents. So I'm blending the concept of more than one item, less than 3 items, and blending that with the symbol of the item, and therefore these 2 concepts have blended. Is that fair?
That's fair. Yeah. Okay. And to realize that that has wide-reaching implications as well. And, you know, 2 of something – and then 2 of something else can also be blended into 4 and things like that too. So our math is part of a cognitive integration as well. Our ability to do those types of things as well. Yeah.
So how do you use that in terms of understanding and treating autism?
People with forms of autism, or people who appear on the spectrum, have a deficit in that ability to one degree or another, in some way, shape, or form along that spectrum. It can exist in language, or it could even exist in mathematics. For example, you could get a child, 7, 8-year-old, and I'm using a case example, who can sit down and read almost anything you put in front of him. And yet you ask him to answer questions about what he read, and he can't answer anything. So he's not made that cognitive jump as to what those words mean and to what are they blended to, what are they assigned to. You know, words don't have – we hear Matt Dillahunty say this all the time. Words don't have meanings. They have usages. Those usages are a blend. But those meanings are not, or those – or learning the word is not a cognitive blend. Being able to see it and then translate it, that's not a blend. But using that to understand another concept, that's the cognitive blend. That's the cognitive integration, or the conceptual integration. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And is that something that – like an autistic person would have a hard time being able to do exactly?
Not all of them. Again, you know one autistic person, you only know one autistic person. That can be a defining feature in general of autism in that way, shape, or form. You like a higher functioning people with autism sometimes usually don't understand sarcasm. They tend to be very literal. I enjoy working with people who appear on the spectrum quite a bit, because what's very refreshing is they don't lie. There's no obfuscation there whatsoever.
Really?
They might be quirky. They might be difficult. They might be moody. They might even appear rude at times, but there's no filter. You know, they're not concerned about your emotions because they don't understand why you'd be concerned about your emotions. So I find that actually kind of refreshing and relaxing to know that there's no one there to stab you in the back.
Does that in some way aid researchers in understanding the psychology of people that, you know, don't have autism? The rest of us, for example, that like by studying an autistic person, does that give us kind of an ability to peer into our own psychology in a way then?
I think so. And I'm just beginning this journey of trying to learn about this myself. What I suspect is that what I would like to see, and unless something I learned proves me wrong, is that we basically look at this as another form of just how the human mind works. And so you're right. It's not only an insight into our psychology, but it's, again, we all are on this continuum to one way or another. To one degree or another, you could put anybody you run into and meet on some point at some very end or towards the middle of some autistic spectrum in some way, shape, or form. And I've heard that from other professionals too that I work with. It's like, you know, the more you work with, the more you realize we're all a little bit this. We all have these moments of this. We all function this way. They just do it at a more refined or extreme manner in certain characteristics of their psychology.
Whoa. Like I'm like rubbing my eyes right now. Like, I'm just like, what? You're saying that this is it's like a sliding scale. It's not like you're either autistic or you're not, or you're either schizophrenic or you're not, or you're either, you know, this or you're not that, or like you're saying, like, this is something that we all kind of blend together. And I'm using the word blend again, but it's all kind of connected.
It's all connected. We're all, and that's the joke. We're all connected.
Oh my God. No, I mean, that's incredible.
Yeah. And it's really, and their dysfunction is really more the fact that our society cannot incorporate them in a more functional manner.
My silence is simply because I'm processing this information.
So they're not the problem. We are. Wow. Our inability to accommodate them, our society's inability to basically, is part of the problem, you know. And obviously, you know, I say that and I say that knowing there are these extreme cases of children with sensory processing disorders where, you know, some type of medication is definitely warranted because the child is, you know, beating their head against the wall or something like that. So we do have these these extremes that do fall under the autistic umbrella with a lot of other comorbidities or other issues going on there. But, you know, just I think it's important that we begin to at least see that these things are in all of us. It's just that, you know, other things are interacting with them and making us appear more functional at the same time. So
I have learned so much. Like, this is one of those, I'm guessing the listener will probably have to rewind it as well. But even though I'm interviewing you, I'm going to have to go back and play a lot of this just to kind of, it probably didn't mean as much to you while you're saying it. It all makes sense. But for me to process everything you're saying, that was a lot of information at once. And I wanted to ask you three questions real quick before I let you go. And also, how can people find you before asking these questions? If they wanted to talk to you more about this, or if they wanted to ask you questions about whether their children had autism or maybe how they can understand cognitive blending better, how can people get a hold of you?
Facebook, Michael Allen Moore on Facebook, basically. It's kind of hard. There's a lot of us. It's a very popular name, obviously.
Michael Allen Moore at Fahrenheit911.com, right? Okay, so one thing, like, I always see autism in relation to, like, boys, but I don't see it in relation to girls. Is it a boy thing, or is it just more common, or what?
It does show a prevalence in males.
What's that about? That's a weird thing, right?
Nobody knows.
Wow.
Nobody knows.
Wow. Okay. Is it genetic? Is autism genetic?
Definitely. Yeah.
Now, whenever we say genetic, does that mean that it comes from the parents in the sense of the parents gave them the autism, or like, is there a meaning to that that's a little bit deeper there?
There's some different theories out there right now. There's a couple different people right now pushing a chemical diet theory of or a chemical poison theory of autism. I actually, as of now, I mean, I could reverse my opinion if given more evidence. As of right now, I suspect that what they're mistaking for autism is really a type of allergy, that where certain types of metals, whether it's copper, are actually crossing the blood-brain barrier and causing autistic-like symptoms. And so when the child is given on a special diet, those symptoms are alleviated and they think, oh, wow, look, we have this diet that cured autism. I suspect that that's not autism. It's a type of allergy response that a very small minority of the population tends to have with certain elements in their diet that creates a type of response that appears like autism.
So maybe what we're calling autism itself is a much broader category than it should be, and that's causing some research and data analysis errors, you're thinking?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and that's why every time there's a new DSM, Diagnostic Statistical Manual, they redefine a lot of these things. They expand it, they contract certain things, and you know, there's an emotional learning disorder that gets misdiagnosed as autism, and it's something else entirely, where the people almost have almost like a blindness as to reading other people's emotions and then responding appropriately. And that can create a lot of confusion. And, you know, I've had a student or client that's had very similar things. I thought to myself, you know, I'd like the doctor to take a look at the student and reconsider, because I don't think it's autism. I think it's something else.
Well, last question. I know you're a busy guy, and I really mean this. I appreciate your time today. I thank you for coming on the show and teaching all of us a little bit more about this. And it honestly, just hearing this up, it's humbling, man. It's humbling. Like, it's a man, like, it just it makes your heart go out to, like, all these people that are struggling to deal with just stuff that we think of as just everyday life. Whenever you said that part about parents possibly treating their children in a certain way, or in the past calling it schizophrenia, or shoving them into some kind of a, you know, a crazy house, you know, as it would have been considered back in the old days or something. Like, man, like, I say all that to say, like, thank you for enlightening us on the topic. But last question. And this is your fault, because you brought it up. So now you got to deal with it, pal. You went religious, and now it's happening. But anyway, so, and in terms of like religious stuff, like you had mentioned that you were atheist. And just before I let you go, I was hoping to kind of get an understanding of Like, did you grow up atheist? Like, did you start out that way, or is this something that you transitioned to?
Yeah, I think my parents were each had their own, I think, individual spiritual beliefs, but I was not indoctrinated into any either one, you know. And as a teenager, I was kind of a get along, go along teenager. I really was into rabble rouser and sort of fell into that whole 1980s evangelical born again Christian movement for a while. If you remember back then.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, I do.
Yeah, yeah. And do you remember how obnoxious they all were?
Yeah. The biggest thing with that time was like the evangelical guy that comes, you know, the evangelist that comes to your church. And like, he just does like this tour thing, like a rock star going from church to church to church or all around the country. And then, you know, he comes to your church and like, they pump you up like weeks before it. You know, they go to your Christian school or they go, you know, the youth group or whatever. And like, everybody's pumped up and this guy gets there and he's like, you're all sinners. Quit masturbating all the time. Get up here and get on your knees. And probably get on your knees was probably a bad euphemism right there. But you know what I mean? I'm just saying it was always about teenagers and jerking off. I don't know. Maybe that was just me because I jerked off a lot. But either way, like, it was just like, I don't know. I don't know if that still goes on today as much, the evangelical thing.
Also, too, there was that whole satanic panic, which was fascinating to me.
Yes.
Being a young kid and loving heavy metal and hard rock. And, of course, and the iconography and the imagery of that music is so heavily based. But I also loved, you know, those old British films from the 60s, the Hammer House horror films, which were always about horror and things like that too. And I never thought for one second that those films were trying to teach me to become a Satanist. I thought those films were just trying to be something spooky to watch on a Saturday afternoon, you know?
And it was always like, play the song in reverse and, and here's what it's going to say. It's going to say, you know, something, something, Satan's kids in secret services or whatever, you know? And then like, it plays it and you're like, oh yeah, I hear that now. But you wouldn't have heard it if they hadn't told you. Like, I always remember they would always play the music in reverse and I'd be like, oh my God, this is satanic.
That's because we project, you know, our brains do a lot of projection and imagination. And, you know, when you're that young and that suggestible, you can easily do that. I think that maybe speak about something about me where I never heard that. So I lacked that type of imaginary thinking. The group that I fell into pushed the satanic kind of thing pretty heavy, and which made me read the Bible, which made me even do some Bible studies for a while and even begin to kind of try to understand, well, what is the ramification of translating, you know, a language from Greek into English or from, you know, Latin or something like this, and what really happens in the translation process and the communication process. And then once in my early 20s, I realized that, well, a lot of meaning is simply changed or corrupted. I really let a lot of it go. And then I got into college and I started studying some philosophy and logic. And then at which point in time I just decided, you know, I guess I'm an atheist, you know, and I think I was probably my early 20s.
What was your guilty pleasure hairband that you knew it was bad, you know, it was satanic, but you jammed the fuck out of it anyway? Who was it? It was Twisted Sister, right?
I was a serious teenager. I loved Iron Maiden, so I loved the
kind of... You were so much cooler than me, man. You were Iron Maiden?
I was Iron Maiden. Yeah. I had the...
You didn't screw around.
No, loved Iron Maiden. I still do. Guilty pleasure, I will pop on Iron Maiden once in a while and crank it really, really loud.
Michael, thank you so much for your time, man. And Michael Allen Moore, Iron Maiden aficionado. I really appreciate your time. Can we talk again sometime? Because I actually want to learn a little bit more about exactly what cognitive blending is, and I feel like we didn't have enough time to really dig into that. But
I'm still learning myself. I'd be happy to pass along what I'm learning in my journey on my way. So yes, thank you so much.
Was a really great guest today. You can tell he really has a heart in what he's doing, can't you? I mean, making a difference in people's lives. Incredible guy. Faith in humanity restored. I love talking to someone that shows me how fascinating the human mind is, but also reminds me about the heart too, you know? The music today was brought to you via A Lost State of Mind. Find more at alostateofmind.com. Next episode is our 25th broadcast. Can you believe that? I'm compiling a best of episode for that occasion. We'll be putting together your favorites, so continue to write in at therighttoreason.com. Hit me up on the Facebook page or at Right to Reason 1 on Twitter with your favorite moments. You've already sent me a lot to work with, so thank you for that. Between now and then, I'll be working on episode 25. You guys keep fighting for your right to reason.